Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for April 13th, 2009, and on this week's episode, we have an interview with Frank Galati, K. Todd Freeman, and John Michael Hill from Steppenwolf's production of Shakespeare's The Tempest. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, Chicago! And let's talk theater.
This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast, and I'm your host, Ann Nicholson-Weber. This week, we're going to be talking about the production of The Tempest that opened very recently at Steppenwolf Theater. And here to talk with me about it are three of the cast members, Frank Galati, who plays Prospero, K. Todd Freeman, who plays Caliban, and John Michael Hill, who plays Ariel, all of whom gave really extraordinary performances. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
One aspect of this production that has elicited a lot of comment is the simple fact of Steppenwolf doing Shakespeare. So I understand that this is the first Shakespeare you've ever done in the history of the ensemble, which is 30 years and counting. And I'm interested to talk something about the melding of the Steppenwolf style or the Steppenwolf culture with Shakespeare and the first time that that's happened. So Frank, maybe you could give me your first impression on that.
Well, I'll try to. I'm not sure, though, that the three of us are entirely new to Shakespeare. Have you not both done Shakespeare?
I've only done the last time I did Shakespeare was in college, a little over 20 years ago.
Wow. I've done a couple of productions of Midsummer, and I came from a classical training program, so we studied Shakespeare and worked on, and I did a play in college too. So,
what training program were you in, John?
This is the University of Illinois in Champaign.
And I was in Shakespeare in college when I was in a summer stock theater for a couple of years when I was in college, and I've directed some Shakespeare. But I think there are a number of us in the company that have done Shakespeare in other places. Tina has certainly directed Shakespeare before. Martha Levy, who's the artistic director of Steppenwolf, played Hermione in the production of Winter's Tale that I directed at the Goodman. So I don't think we're entirely new to Shakespeare, but I guess we can understand that people who maybe think of us as being sort of realistic or naturalistic or, particularly interested in contemporary life, contemporary themes, that we wouldn't turn to Shakespeare. But Shakespeare is eternal and timeless, so we're having a ball doing it, and we, I think, have been led by Tina Landau into a region of theatricality and truth that's really consistent with Steppenwolf's aesthetic.
For some reason it doesn't seem, the process of working on this with Tina just seemed like another play we were doing at Steppenwolf. It didn't seem like it was Shakespeare. We had our text coach, our verse coach, Rob Clare, who came from Oxford to work with us, but even his aesthetic really blended with our sort of way of life and thinking. So it just, for me, it always kind of seemed just like another play.
Well, why not just characterize, though, what is your way of life? What is your way of thinking that you're talking about there?
John.
Pass the buck.
Well, I think it's basically rooted in truth. I think, like, Tina's attack, she really requires it to be very personal of everyone there, you know, the work that they do. And, I mean, she puts in so much research and hours of work that you really feel guilty if you're not, you know, working just as hard as she is.
But there are lots of kinds of truth. I mean, you know, that is something that I doubt any actor will tell you that they're doing anything other than telling their truth. And yet, clearly, there are big differences in style certainly among texts, and I would say also acting styles between mm-hmm. companies and through time and in different places. So I guess I want to be a little more specific about, because I guess the reason I'm interested in it, because I do think that the combination of something that you all bring to this because of, I imagine because of the culture of Steppenwolf, has created something quite unusual, I feel, in this production as a version of Shakespeare. So I'm kind of trying to dig around at what that is.
Well, I think part of our informing idea is that we want to sound like ourselves. Mm-hmm. We want to sound the way... I mean, that sounds strange maybe to say, but because it isn't just a matter of sounding... You know, it isn't just the tone of voice. It's just that this is the way we talk and this is the way we use language. And what we always, I think, try to do in our rehearsal process is find out what our intentions are in the scene, what the action is in the scene, what are the needs that we have as characters in the scene. And then to kind of tap into the vein of truth that's there in the lines that we're given to speak in with Shakespeare, because it is so profoundly deep and so dependable. You know, we don't have to stretch for the truth, which I think, you know, sometimes we do have to do.
You kind of have to fix it a little bit.
Well, you do. You know, you have to find your own kind of truth in a place where you maybe don't quite believe it, you know, perhaps. But in the case of this play, it seemed, I think for the three of us and the whole cast, we're, you know, we're being lifted up and fueled by what Shakespeare has crafted, which is just genius beyond genius.
Yeah. I think I would say that the focus a lot around Steppenwolf is the ensemble and how we all work together, and I think that's one of the reasons Tina was such a perfect choice to like be directing it, because the way she works with an ensemble is extraordinary. She's really good at, first of all, casting, and then using the viewpoints work we did in rehearsal. It just kind of made an environment of, you know, where people could really be fearless with each other and trusting. And so it allowed, I think, it definitely allowed me to, you know, open up and really, you know that I was supported in the room. And so I think that has something to do with.
You mentioned viewpoints, and I feel like we should maybe, can any of you quickly characterize what that is for people who aren't actors and haven't read the book?
I think it's a like it starts off with sets of exercises, but they're all movement-based. Mm-hmm. And it's a movement-based way for actors to get in touch with what's happening in a scene, or get in touch with themselves and how to work, and get in touch with the character, and get in touch with this weird set to work from a physical, an external way inside, going from the outside as opposed to the inside out. Mm-hmm. But it's very internal as a way. I hate to say outside, because it's very internal once you start getting physical and... it's just a different way of working. It's a movement-based way of working.
Can any of you just quickly give an example of how you used a viewpoints exercise to find something that then became important in your characterization? Is that, did that happen?
Yeah.
She, spatial relationship is one of the points. And just in, you kind of figure out what it is to be extremely close to someone physically and what that does. And how it is when, like, John is standing next to Frank, and what it is when Ariel is standing next to Prospero. And sometimes, I mean, we'll be up there, and then she will, you know, throw in things, like throw in a line from your, you know, from the play. And that sort of puts you in the world of the Tempest, so things change. And then, I mean, I think it was just the feeling of being next to someone where your relationship is servant master, or, you know, father son, it just changes from what your relationship is
to your fellow actor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting because it was the first time I worked with Tina, although I was familiar with viewpoints, and I'm one of those actors who normally is like, you know, leave the exercises to cut to the college classroom and let's just get to work here. Uh-huh. But I was very willing to do this with Tina, and so I did. And we did it. The biggest sessions were like the first couple of days of rehearsal, and I was very, not surprised, but I was very glad. It was so informative. There was one day in particular that Frank and John and Alana, who plays Miranda, and then Stefano and Trinculo, Yasin Pinyakov and Tim Hopper, we were all sort of up there together. And we found such lovely, all of us found such lovely things. And I know I'm particular, by the time we started to actually get into text and started getting up on stage in the space to rehearse, it had taken some sort of burden off. It became slightly easier. Mm-hmm. And also, I would say, it helped me do the thing that I think we were talking about previously with you, is making it so real to ourselves that it then becomes part of the Steppenwolf thing, you know?
Right.
It just sort of like made it much more real and grounded in that quote-unquote truth we keep talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That just made it more natural and more of me.
Yeah, it was the first time for me, too, working with Tina. And although I'd heard a lot and seen some examples in rehearsals over the years of viewpointing, I didn't really know. I hadn't read the book or anything. I didn't really know. But like you, I was a little, not resistant at first, but just unsure of how well I would get it and be able to, you know, really contribute. But so many things are revealed that are unexpected sort of points of entry into character and into the world of the work. And one of the things that I found really informative and surprising was the way sympathies are kind of traded. You know, you learn to by focusing what Tina calls soft focus. You don't look at a specific opposite point, even in the eyes of your fellow ensemble members, you kind of look into the middle distance. And as you move through a series of exercises that have different topics, architecture or kinetics, and so on, and as you move through in this soft focus, your peripheral vision kind of expands. So you become very aware of things that are way in the margin of your eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
And by being encouraged by Tina, who talks through most of the process, you learn to harmonize with each other or to pull into and away and in various ways interact with each other. I thought it was just, you know, it was really quite a revelation to me.
Wow.
And I think we really did develop a lot of the show's physical world through those fundamentals.
Mm. I guess I want to talk just very quickly more about the verse speaking, which is obviously the one element of Shakespeare that's probably something, except to the extent you've done Shakespeare, you haven't done a lot of. How much of a challenge was that? I mean, there certainly are people who, you know, consider that to be a lifetime study, how to speak that verse. You kind of were doing crash course, at least. Kay Todd, since you were saying that this was, you know, something you hadn't done for 20 years. How did that go?
I hadn't done it for 20 years. And even in college, I had a British dean who taught us our Shakespeare, and he said, whenever I did Shakespeare, it sounded like I was doing Sam Shepard, which I loved the comment, but he didn't mean it as a compliment.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because you said that in one of the podcasts that's up on the Steppenwolf, and that was recorded before you had gone into rehearsal. Mm-hmm, you were still in art. Do you feel any differently about
now? No.
Okay, you're going to stick by that.
No, I stick by it. I still pretty much think I sound like Sam Shepard, or like I'm doing a Shepard play.
Right.
But Rob Clare was fantastic, and he taught me to not be not uptight about the verse, but just I would get irritated with people who are such verse purists that, and whenever I've seen people give those performances, I've not liked any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had like this thing in my head about it, which working with Rob, he kind of just like got rid of that. And so I felt like I was able to speak freely like a person, yet going by the rules that, or however you want to call them, rules, but just kind of like sort of by not ignoring the verse, though. Mm-hmm. He taught me how to use the verse and yet do what I do, mm-hmm. which made me feel comfortable about being inventive and creative. And he would say, you know, if you want to use it here, do. If you don't, don't. Mm-hmm.
Was there anything, did you find any time that the verse added something that if you had been resisting it, it would have, you would have lost something?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Can you give an example?
Just sometimes, the biggest thing for me was, you know, the line ending mm-hmm. as opposed to punctuation within the line. Mm-hmm. And Rob would say, you know, just try a little light pause at the end of the line and just see what it does. And I know that I'm very aware of when I work, I pay no attention to punctuation at all, ever, in a normal script. And I know...
Playwrights are rolling in their graves.
Yeah, I know that. But, and I always just find how I want to say it. And so when I was working with Rob, I just kind of did that. Mm-hmm. And I would discover where I was naturally ending at the end of the verse line, which uh-huh. happened a lot. Uh-huh. So, and that took a lot of pressure off of me. I was like, oh, well, it's just happening. It's occurring naturally. Right. Right. And then I would say, well, now where is it that now can I actually, am I not doing it and use it and see if that still feels good inside my heart? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it wouldn't. And if it didn't, I would say, now let me use the punctuation that's in. See, maybe I'll just stop at the punctuation. And so I was able to just like go back and forth between those things mm-hmm. and just feel okay about it.
Yeah, he used the word invitations. The line endings are, he would say it's like an invitation to use when it serves you mm-hmm. is how we were approaching that.
But don't feel enslaved by it.
Right. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I've always loved the verse. I love, you know, working on it. And it's just something, like I write poetry, spoken word poetry, and there's some kind of rhythm, there's a life that lives in it. But this is the first time where I was able to really experiment and try my best to, you know, make it my own, you know, how I would speak mm-hmm. it. And I think it's a very natural thing to, you know, what is that moment when you get to the end of the verse line before you continue on with the next one? Is your character searching? Mm-hmm. Are they, you know, reaching out for something? So it was, and then we do that in speech, you know, we mm-hmm. pause and we say, it's just, you know, that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the first time I really saw that and really got to work on it. I mean, he brought in scenes and monologues from other plays that, you know, he had a little workshop with us, and that's what we did. We experimented on that and really kind of focused.
When you wouldn't be invested in your own character or worrying mm-hmm. about, yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
I found that very helpful. That's good.
Well, I mean, I would just say my own experience of it was, unlike you, Keitab, I have heard Shakespeare spoken in that kind of declamatory, we might say, British way, and found it very beautiful and you know, really not just admired, but been moved by people who can create the music of it so, you know, beautifully. And I would say that that was less part of this production, but what was traded for that, I would say, is a kind of... It's what you were saying, Frank, that it sounded just conversational. It just sounded so natural. It was so unpretentious, kind of, and very direct and very simple. And that, for me, just put a different spin on these words mm-hmm. that I've heard, you know, many times before. And a classic example, I mean, a strong example would be, you know, the most famous of Prospero's speeches, probably, which is the... No, you better do it. I'm not even going to start. But
you mean we are such stuff as yes. dreams are made of?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you delivered that, as I recall it, directly to Ferdinand. Is that right?
Yes, Ferdinand and Miranda.
And you're just speaking. You're not doing a speech, do you know?
Can I interrupt real briefly? Just say that, just to Frank's credit, Frank follows the verse almost perfectly, uh-huh. more than anybody on stage. Uh-huh. So he uses it better than anyone, and that's probably why you never. Rob would always say, if you use it that well, you never know that you're actually using
it.
Yeah,
right.
But Kay Todd has a couple of speeches. One about the sounds in the island in your mm-hmm. in your Trinculo Stefano scene with Caliban. And I listen to it off stage every night. It's before I have an entrance. And what is so astonishing is that you acknowledge the beauty of the verse, and that is one of the joys of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And when you hear a sort of Shakespearean delivery, you can still appreciate the beauty. But the remarkable thing about Gaétan and this approach in some of those speeches, the danger of the beauty is something that we've been alerted to be careful of, because if we too
start singing it
if it's savored in a way that, you know, kind of, I don't know, shines the actor,
right,
it the brightness of that obscures the character.
Listen to me speaking this so
beautifully. It has nothing to do with that.
I'm Caliban and I have something to say.
That's right. I mean, we are in character and in scene, and while we may be speaking ravishing verse, some passages in the play are more, you know, heightened poetically than other passages. Right. We have intentions and needs, and we want to feel that we believe ourselves, not just that we believe we're speaking Shakespeare well.
Right. Did you, Frank, did you have any insecurity about taking this role on?
Oh, yes, of course. Enormous insecurity. But
well, be specific. What did you say? I'm not fill in the blank enough.
Well, smart enough. God, my brain isn't can't hold this. I mean, I wasn't sure. I was afraid just of the magnitude of the text and the material. Mm-hmm. But you reach fairly early on, I think, a stage where you're sort of swinging in the hold of it. You know, I don't know how to say it. It's very mysterious. It's, we sometimes laugh. People come back and say, how did you ever memorize all those lines? And it is something that people say to us. And we don't know, really. Mm-hmm. We don't really know quite how we do it. But there's something very mysterious about the link between the inner life of a human being and the living potential of a text to be uttered forth with, with truth. I mean, where is the play when we're not playing it? We can go over our lines without even speaking. We can do, I find that a kind of amazing thing. You know, people who study memory and, people like Oliver Sacks, who are very interested in neurology and the science of memory and the human mind, are very mystified by this process. Mm-hmm. Musicians, composers who can hold an entire score in their head and actually hear the music, all the instruments in the orchestra.
Right.
I mean, Shakespeare helps you to understand what a kind of cosmic constellation you have inside of your head. It's just thrilling and strange.
Well, there's so many aspects of this production we could talk about, but one that I found very interesting was the racial or not casting. Was it colorblind or was it not colorblind? So just to kind of create the background for that, both Caliban and Ariel, John and Kaytot are African-American. Miranda is African-American, and Antonio, Frank's brother, Prospero's brother, is African-American. And so you come in and you say, okay, this is colorblind casting because Miranda's black and Antonio's black and Prospero's not, so I'm just going to assume that that's the story. I'm not going to think about it, which is very commonly done in Shakespeare. We don't worry about it. And then there comes a point, John, where you, for the only time in the play, I would say, make a clear reference to your race, doing kind of a step and fetch it thing with the come and go speech, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested to hear what any of you has to say about that. Was it, from the outset that was part of the intention? Did it happen during rehearsal? How did you feel about it?
As I recall, all that was discovered in the process. From what Tina said, I think it was colorblind, and she really wasn't thinking about making a statement, I don't think. And Miranda, we were so thankful for her. She has this line where she calls Keitai a poor slave and talks about, you know, his vile race. And she was like, the way this casting is, you know, I can't personally ignore that I'm looking, mm-hmm. you know, at this person. And it basically came out that we should acknowledge it and mm-hmm. use that, see what's there. And it opened up so many different worlds inside of worlds in this play. And for me, I don't know, getting to that speech, it was actually screaming at me, because Puck has a lot of lines where it's you know, the verse is different and he's doing like a charm. And it's,
do you mean Puck in Midsummer?
Yeah, Puck in Midsummer. Mm-hmm. And Ariel really doesn't have anything like that. If he does, it's a song. But this particular, you know, short speech that he had, it was unlike anything. It wasn't a song. Like in the script, it would say, you know, he sings,
right?
It didn't say that here. And it was, you know, it's this different thing. So I was wondering, what is this? And I mean, at that point in the play, he's been running around doing all kinds of crazy stuff for Prospero, and he's, you know,
when
resisting.
When am I
going
to be done with this?
Yeah. So I don't know. It just kind of screamed at me that this is something different. And there's a lot of little clues in that all over the text, and you just kind of attack them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know. When I heard we were doing it and Tina was directing, I emailed Tina to be Caliban, and she was like, yes. I mean, and then, so it wasn't like she pre-planned, I want Keitai to be Caliban. It wasn't like that, you know, in her head, at least to my knowledge. And then the first day of rehearsals, she asked me, how am I with being shackled?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm fine. I have no problem with it. But she said, you mentioned the other, in some other, you know, production or whatever, some show she had done, that she wanted an African American to be shackled, and this person had a problem with it. And so I said, then my mind opened up, and oh, well, yeah, but I'm so provocative, I think, sometimes in my thinking, that like, I'm like, you know, yes, let's go for it. And I think what was great about this, in a way, is you mentioned that it has an ambiguous quality. It's not placeable, because she's not trying to make a statement. We're not making a statement, but yet the statement, it's there. Mm-hmm. So you can't ignore the imagery of it.
Right.
And every time I come on, I'm shackled in a different way. Sometimes by a dog leash, which is a horrible sort of thought process in your head, or, you know, just by a manacle. And so I think it raises questions, and I think that's all it should do.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more than that. Nothing's being answered. Nothing's being said. It's just being thought about. And I think that's kind of what Frank and I were just talking kind of before we started this whole thing. But kind of what's great about the production and what Tina has done is just, and what Shakespeare's done, because it's Illyria. It's an imaginary place.
Right.
And so she just raises questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fantastic. That's what theater should do.
Yeah.
You know, it just raises the question, and you answer it 20 years from now on your own, if it has an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, to me, the production has a feeling of having been created very empirically. There was no theory coming in that we're going to say this, or this is going to be the production that's about this. I felt like you just did stuff and something happened.
Well,
do you know?
Yeah, it's very true, really.
And
that's a wonderful way to put it, empirically,
uh-huh.
you know, because it's kind of how we did it. And I think, too, that there's something about the reflection of the ensemble, the diversity in the ensemble, mm-hmm. and the sense of family, mm-hmm. which is full of strife and conflict and factions, brothers, fathers, mm-hmm. daughters, sisters, cousins. You know, we're all constellated in different flavors, and, you know, yet we're all part of the same human family. Mm-hmm. So I think we feel blessed that we've been kind of, you know, liberated into this level of living and expressing human life together, mm-hmm. without these, you know, terrible cliches of race that are so shriveling.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, I think maybe the highest praise I can give it is you just leave and say, God, that's a great play.
You know? Well, that's wonderful.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I would love to talk more, but you actually have to go put on makeup. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of April 13th, 2009. The Chicago Park District's 57th annual Theater on the Lake season features reprisals of eight diverse Chicago theater companies performing for five evenings only at the Lakefront Theater on Lake Michigan. The 2009 Theater on the Lake season opens with Collabor Action Theater Company's John. The futuristic allegory runs from June 17th through the 21st. Next is Red Moon Theater's Once Upon a Time, or The Secret Language of Birds. This urban fairy tale can be seen June 24th through the 28th. Blind Faith Theater Company's musical celebration Woody Guthrie's American Song, that runs from July 1st through the 5th. Then Theo Ubique Theater Company's Jacques Brel's Lonesome Loser of the Night. The musical review runs from July 8th through the 12th. Rivendell Theater Ensemble's real-life story These Shining Lives can be seen July 15th through the 19th. Barrel of Monkeys Ensemble hit Fun O'Clock, the very special That's Weird, Grandma, that can be seen July 22nd through the 26th. The Artistic Homes Juno and the Paycock. This rich and moving story runs from July 29th through August 2nd. Eclipse Theater Company's rip-roaring comedy Plaza Suite by Neil Simon caps off the season, running from August 5th through the 9th. One of this year's new features for the season includes three family-friendly productions recommended for ages 6 and up. The Chicago Park District's Theater on the Lake is located at Fullerton Avenue and Lakeshore Drive. For more information on all these shows and a detailed schedule, click on over to Theater in Chicago's news website. Timeline Theater Company announces three of their four plays for its 2009-2010 season, dedicated to plays inspired by history and connects us to today's social and political issues. The 2009-2010 Timeline Theater season includes When She Danced, an incredibly funny portrait of the legendary dancer Isadora Duncan. That's been written by Mark Sherman and will be directed by Nick Bowling. Then Timeline will produce Master Harold and the Boys by Athol Fugard, and it is widely considered Fugard's masterpiece. And also they will have the Chicago premiere of The Farnsworth Invention by Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin is the creator of A Few Good Men and The West Wing. The fourth play and the season's detailed schedule are yet to be announced. For more information, read the article on our news section. Evanston's Next Theater Company and their new artistic director Jason Sutherland has announced his first full season roster of plays, comprising Next's 29th season and continuing the tradition of an exciting slate of new plays by a diverse group of writers. This season, theatergoers will find the highly anticipated world premiere of War with the Newts, also the poignant drama Return to Haifa, and the offbeat apocalyptic comedy Boom. Also added is a holiday program called A Very Merry Unauthorized Children's Scientology Pageant. That should be a good one. The final play of the 29th season will be announced shortly. Subscriptions to Next Theater Company's 2009-2010 season are currently on sale. Visit our website for more information. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Frank Galati, K. Todd Freeman, and John Michael Hill for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with the new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.